children used to play hide and seek in the bushes in the grounds outside the house. It was a marvellous place for them to play. And when the tennis courts and putting greens weren't in use, they used to go out and play tennis and have a game of putting. They were also regular viewers in the TV lounge too. That was the first television set that we'd ever seen. So the youngsters were made up with it was magic. You used to go in there and watch the children's programmes and that, and programmes in the mornings for children. They loved it there. And our son Philip was born there too, on the 20th of September in 1956. The eldest girl, Linda, was born in London. Leslie was born in Orkney. And Philip was born in Rochdale. Quite some miles apart, isn't it? Now, the regulars were all good friends and patient with the children, and they would play with them. We made many good friends there. There's one, John Clark, and his wife Lily. He was a grand chap, one of the nicest chaps I ever met. He was the same age as me. And I believe in 1939, he had a trial with Manchester United Football Club. Well, I was told that he was an exceptionally good player. Quite a few of the chaps at Rochdale told me what a good player John had been in his youth. But the war had come, so he joined up. Joined the army. And I think it was in North Africa, I'm not too sure. But he lost half of his left arm. So that would have paid to us any thoughts of playing football. And I don't think he ever worked after the war. He was on a pension, of course. But he was absolutely, extremely nice chap. Always a smile on his face and always a joke. And he used to tell these jokes to me, and to emphasise them, he used to tap you with this stump of his arm. His arm was off from just above the elbow. But it used to be quite sore when he nudged you with this. I used to have Wednesday afternoon half day. Sometimes I'd go into Manchester with them and go to a football match, or sometimes went to the cinema. We just seemed to pal up. He was a great guy. You know, he was about, well built chap, he'd be about 5'10", I would say. Well built, you know, he would have made a good footballer. His wife Lil was a small, jovial woman, a bit on the plump side. She thought the world of John. Her mother was deaf and dumb, and Lil had learned the deaf and dumb language using her hands. She looked after her mother and at her home, and she also done a lot of good charity work for the deaf and dumb folk in Rochdale area. A great couple they were. Shortly after we left Rochdale, John died suddenly. I often thought it may have been from his war wounds. I'm not too sure, but he wouldn't have been very old when he died, I'd say in his 30s. Another couple we became friendly with were Fred and Betty Halliwell. They were a few years older than Nina and I. They were real Lancastrians with broad Rochdale accents. Well, most of the people there had strong Lancashire accents. They had two teenage daughters. They were often up at the club with them, and they played with our children. They lived a few hundred yards down the road from the club in Sudden, the village of Sudden. They were a jolly couple. Then there was a Mr. and Mrs. Clancy who came regularly with their... Alsatian dog. It was a massive dog. It was called Sheba. Real beautiful. Another friend, chap we made friends with, we never saw much of his wife, but he was a regular there. John Jarman, his name was. A small, about my size, very thin, wiry. He wore glasses and he always had a big grin on his face, always laughing. And I talked to him in the bar one day and I told him I was going to decorate the flat. He says, "No, you're not. I'll do it." So I said, no. So he insisted, so I said, "Okay, you know, let me know." He'd done it in his spare time, apparently, decorating in the evenings and weekends around the area. So I said, "Okay, I'll pay, you know, let me know how much and I'll pay." So he said, no money. He said, "Just keep me supplied in beer." Well, I've never, ever seen anyone decorate a room so fast and good as John Jarman. He was absolutely out of this world. You had to see it to believe it. He turned up with his decorator's apron and pasting table and brushes, etc. Set them up, then he measured all the walls. Then he cut all the rolls of paper into lengths, every one, and placed them face down on top of each other on the pasting table. Then he mixed the paste, and he told me to go and get some beer. So I come up with the beer, give him a pint of beer, and he said, "Right," he said. He had a drink, and he said, "Now you keep pasting those strips of paper." There were high walls too. So I pasted and then brought him the first length. From then on, he worked like a machine. I would never have believed it. It took me all my time to keep up pasting, to keep him going. He's having a quick drink of beer in between each length. In no time, the room was done, and no mess at all. And sweat was pouring off him. It was an education to watch him. An amazing man. I could never forget him. There were others too. There was a Clive Oxton. He was up in, worked in the main office in the Counts branch, I think. He was from Liverpool. He lived down the road in what I think was a company house belonging to Dunlop. There were quite a few houses on the road alongside the mill, and quite a few of the office staff worked there, lived there. Then there was a chief engineer in the maintenance department. He was an extremely nice man too. I can't recall his name. He lived in one of these houses too. And he came to the Isle of Man with his wife for their holidays every year. They always stayed every year at the Hotel Metropole on the promenade, he told me. And I remember a chap on the painting staff. They had their own joiners, plumbers and painters in the mill, you know, and they used to come up in the lunch hour and have a pint. They were quite big drinkers, and weekends. And this chap, he had a real worried looking face with his brow wrinkled, you know, and he was one of the type who were never happy unless he had something to moan about. His mates used to egg him on and make jokes about him. It was very funny. This year he bought a brand new Ford Consul car, not long before they went on their holidays. He was always washing and polishing it. He used to keep it up by the club so that it wouldn't get damaged with anybody else who had a car getting out of the lorries in the mill yard. He used to come up every dinner time, looking for marks and polishing it up. Of course, not a lot of working class folk had cars then. So he went off on his holidays with his wife, and when he returned from his holiday, he was moaning about the trouble he had looking after the car. Apparently, they went touring, and they would never stop for lunch anywhere. They had to look out for a cafe or restaurant where they could park the car outside and get a table in the window to keep their eyes on it. So, and at night time, when they stayed at a hotel or a boarding house, if he couldn't park the car near the place, he would sleep in the car all night while she slept in the hotel or boarding house. Oh, he said, it was funny, though, the lads would take the mickey out of him. So, on the last day, they parked outside a cafe. When they got in, somebody had got into the seat in the window first. When they came out after the meal, he found he had a parking ticket on the car. Oh, the lads didn't half laugh. And there was I remember a man too. I would say he was in his early 60s. He used to come into the bar every lunchtime. He never missed. And all he bought was a packet of Rolo with a chocolate-coated toffees. He was a Ukrainian, and he couldn't speak English. The only word I ever heard him say was Rolo, and he used to point to all them. Now, every year, the Rochdale Observer newspaper held a bowls tournament, and they always held the semi-finals and the finals at the Dunlop Bowling Green. That was because it was so well known as such a good bowling green. Now, this event attracted about 1,800 to 2,000 spectators. They used to have bookies there, running books, taking bets on who would win. Ooh, it was a real hectic time. In the bar, it was absolutely packed. While the games were on, there'd only be a few people in the bar. But in between each game, there was a mad rush from the bowling green a short distance up the path into the bar for drinks. We had to have extra staff, of course, but it was hectic. And then they used to take the drinks outside onto the lawns. We used to have to, when they all rushed off for the next game, the next semi-final, you had to rush out and get all the glasses in and wash them before the next semi-final was over. Then when the last semi-final was over, they'd all be back again. Then we'd rush up to see the final. Oh, it was hectic. Well, one year, a Dunlop worker, he was a labourer in the engineer staff, he'd won his way through to the semi-finals. His name was Alf. I forget his surname, but he was a real character. He was a small man, and he always wore a grey Macintosh and an Anthony Eden type black Hamburg hat. He was a terrible hard drinker, and he was, more than often than not, he was well under the weather. And he used to walk into the bar, and he used to say, "You don't know me." And I used to say, "You don't know me. I am the man in black. Everyone knew him and called him the Man in Black. When I thought he'd had enough, I used to refuse to serve him and say, "Go on home, Alf. Go home for your tea." And he used to say, "What's the use? The wife can't cook." Oh, he used to make us laugh. How do you answer that? When it came to the time of the semi-finals, I was told to ban him from the bar by the chief engineer. They were all trying to keep him sober until they got to the finals. So we used to tell him no, but he used to go up at pubs in Sudden or Castleton, I think. One night he went home and stood outside the house, called his wife names, and he threw his bag of balls through the window. Anyway, he won his semi-final and he got into the final game. But he was narrowly beaten in the final. What a character, the Man in Black. We had an attempted break-in at the club too, so I bought an Alsatian puppy. It was a beautiful dog, a bitch. We named it Fiona. She grew to be a massive size. This Mr. Clancy, who had the Alsatian Sheba, he told us, he said, "Feed it the best meat, but the first 6 months either steak or mincemeat." And he said it'll make a big strong dog, he said, and save paying vet's fees later on. So that's what we done, and she grew an enormous size. But she was a marvellous pet and a great house dog. We had a budgie at the time, which was hardly ever in the cage. It was often flying, always flying around the room, and often it would go down onto the floor and play with the children. Now Fiona, the Alsatian, she used to pick the bird up in its mouth and bring it to either Nina or I and place the bird gently on your knee. She's very intelligent too. When we finished at night and I used to close the place up, I used to take her for a walk round the grounds. Now there were quite a number of paths and junctions through these grounds. I used to set off with her running ahead of me. She wasn't on the lead, and she'd go out of sight. And when I'd arrive at a junction of paths, she'd be sitting there waiting for me. And she wouldn't move until I told her either left or right. She would jump up and set off whichever path I told her. And she never, ever made a mistake. She was a wonderful dog. And she played with a lot of the youngsters from the mill when they came over at lunchtime. And she was a good guard dog too. Nina used to put Philip in his pram and put the pram in the passageway just outside the bar where we could keep her in our vision, where we could keep an eye on him all the time. And Fiona would sit or lie by the pram and watch him. One day when the crowd had gone back to the mill, it was quiet, a man came, as he usually did. He was a stoker from the boiler house. A nice man, Bill his name was, I can't think of his other name. And he always had a yarn with us, a very pleasant, quiet man. This day he was talking to me at the bar, leaning on the bar having his beer, when Philip threw a rattle out of the pram. Bill picked it up and he bent down and held the rattle into the pram, saying, "Here, I'm a young fella." As soon as he bent into the pram, Fiona gave a growl and she jumped up at him and knocked him to the ground. She had this man pinned on the ground. I was round the bar in a flash and got her off. This Billy was all right, and I apologised, but he said, "No," he says, "my mistake, I shouldn't have put my hand into the pram." right away, the dog was okay with him, licking his hand and all friendly. I thought the world of that dog. She was a beauty. Well, the time came for holidays, and we'd arranged to go over to the Isle of Man and stay with my sister Winnie for a fortnight. So we arranged for the dog to go to the kennels for the fortnight while we were away. So we had our good holiday and come back and got in the house. And that evening, the man from the kennels brought the dog back in his van. As soon as he let her out of the van, she flew at us, her teeth bared and jumping up on us. He managed to get a choke around her neck, but she wouldn't calm down. Every time I went near and tried to talk to her, she went mad, crazy, trying to bite me all the time. It went on for nearly an hour. Eventually I asked the fella how had she been with him while she was in the kennels. Well, he said, no trouble at all, great. He said, this is the first time I've seen her do this. In the end, I told him, I said, I can't risk taking that dog into the house now with the children, the wife and children, so I asked him if he would keep her or get rid of her. He says, oh no, he said, I wouldn't get rid of her. I'll have her if you, sure you don't want her. I said, yes, you know, take good care of her. And he took her away. It nearly broke my heart. I could only think she turned against us for sending her to the kennels. That's the only thing I could think of. So I vowed I would never put a dog in the kennels again. And in the mill, they had a Christmas club for buying drinks at Christmas time. People paid so much a week over a period of months, and about a month before Christmas they had to put in their orders. These orders were made up then in the office and brought over to the club to me. Now, over the ensuing months I had to keep collecting cardboard boxes. Then when the orders were all in, I had to total up all the items required and place orders with the breweries. And then when the breweries delivered them, I had to sort them all out and stack them up. When all the stocks were in, I had to make up each person's order, placed in a cardboard box. Like if a person wanted two bottles of whiskey, a bottle of gin, a bottle of port wine or something, I had to put them in a cardboard box and their order with it. It was a mammoth job. There were about 800 orders. So it entailed a lot of time and work. And as I made them up, the orders had to be locked in rooms in the basement. And I had to check them regularly for safety. And about a fortnight before Christmas, people came to collect their orders. I had it arranged for different nights, so that, like on Monday, folk whose names started with the letters A to H, say, and then on Tuesday, people whose names started with I to L, and so on, through the week. But what a job it was. They all had to be sorted in alphabetical order. And all this with no extra pay, of course. The nights that the people came to collect their orders, they had a few drinks in the bar, of course. So that made the sales in the bar rise. I'm telling you, I was glad to see Christmas over and done with. Working bar stock, if worked correctly and efficiently, produce a surplus over and above the normal profit. That is a standard thing. The last Christmas we worked there was just over £200 surplus. This was amazing. I never heard of. I double-checked the figures, treble-checked. Then Nina checked and double-checked. Mr. Grimshaw came around for his usual check of the books. When I told him of the large surplus, he said that was impossible. Well, he checked it, he double-checked it. He still wouldn't believe it. And he took the books away to be audited by the accounts department at the main mill offices. Next day he brought the books back and confirmed them correct. He was really pleased and congratulated me. A couple of weeks later he came to see me and he said that the committee had decided to have a party for themselves and their wives. Duly, they held a party in the Green Lounge, as they called it, and they had a grand time in there and kept ringing the bell for me to go in and take their orders and then go back with their drinks. When the party ended, the committee all came and thanked me as they left. And then Mr. Grimshaw gave me 3 tuppenny bars of chocolate for the children. 3 2-pence bars of chocolate for the children. They never even bought Nina and I a single drink. So that, it hurt me and knocked me back. So the next time Mr. Grimshaw came to check the bar stocks, I told him, there won't be any more big surpluses, Mr. Grimshaw. I didn't tell him why, but I'd made my mind up there and then that Nina and I were worth better treatment than that. So I started looking in the papers for other positions. Before leaving Rochdale, I must recall, Philip Brides and my old pal was sailing on the Isle of Man steam packet cargo boat, the Peveril, at that time. So if the Peveril was in dock at Liverpool for the weekend, he would come up to Rochdale and have a couple of days with us. He done this quite often. He came one weekend and he and I were in the bar having a drink. There was no customers in and nobody else about. We were both reading different things. And I had the Rochdale Observer and was looking at the adverts. I saw one I thought funny. I read it out to him. Wanted, Hard Rock Miners for Canada. That gave an address to write to up for forms. He surprised me. He sat up and he said, that sounds good. What about it, eh? Well, I'm having a try. So I said, well, okay then. So he said to me, write away for a couple of application forms. And I said, okay. And I did just that. The forms duly arrived and I left him till he turned up again. A fortnight later, he came up for the weekend. As soon as he arrived, I told him that I had the forms. True to his form, he said, oh, it's too late. I've already got fixed up. I'm off to Canada in 10 days' time. I said, bloody hell, why didn't you get in touch with me? It turned out that he had read the same advert again in the Liverpool Echo and it gave a Liverpool address, so he'd gone round there, had a medical, passed and got fixed up. Real Philip Brideson style. So it was to work in a gold mine in Ontario. A week later he came and stayed overnight and then he went to Manchester the following day to get a plane to Toronto. He told me that he had sold his motorbike and all the furniture, which made enough money to last his wife Dorothy and the 4 children until February. By that time he hoped to have somewhere fixed up to send for them. I think it was in October when he left. It wasn't all that many weeks before I received a letter from him saying that he had got a mine company house and asked me if I would see Dorothy and the family off in November. Now, Dorothy and the children had never been off the Isle of Man, so were bound to find it all strange. I arranged to meet them at Rochdale Railway Station, which I did. Their children were all small and quite a handful. I had a job keeping them all together to get them on the right bus to take us out to the club. The four children all had duffel coats on and Wellington boots, and little Joan, she was carrying a doll, a big doll. Eventually I got them and all their luggage on the bus and brought them home to the club. The following day I took them into Manchester to the British Airways place in Deansgate. Dorothy was quite lost in strange surroundings, so I saw to all the arrangements for them. The four kids kept wandering off and picking bags up and doing different things. The man said to me, "Are those your bloody kids?" I said, "No." He said, "I'll get a bit of rope or something and tie them together or they're going to get lost." And he did that. I waited until the bus arrived to take them off to the airport. And I believe they were all sick on the plane journey. However, they arrived there safely and soon settled into the life in Canada. The eldest boy, Jimmy, became a mining engineer's superintendent. Michael, the second son, is an accountant. Joan, the daughter, was a teacher and was married to a mine manager. And Edward, the youngest boy, he is the head of a maths department at a big school in Toronto. And then Dorothy also found work with the Bank of Canada. I tried at that time to talk Nina into going there, but she wouldn't. She wouldn't have it. She said she wouldn't like the cold winters and the snow. But they're not really so bad, and they all have central heating and air conditioning in the houses, and the snow is not wet like it is here. I often wonder if we would have done so well as that family if we'd have gone at the time. They'd done very well for themselves. I kept looking in the paper for jobs which would be a change for the better. Eventually I saw one which sounded promising. I think it was in June. It was for a post of assistant groundsman steward with wife to assist part-time at the Manchester College of Science and Technology. The advert stated that there was a flat provided, so it sounded very good. I wrote after it, but the weeks went by and we never heard anything. So eventually we went on holiday to Winnie's again in the Isle of Man. Having given up all hopes of hearing about the job. When we arrived back in Rochdale after the holidays, I found a letter from the College of Technology asking for me to attend for an interview on that date, the day we arrived back. So I rang up and apologised for failing to attend the interview and thank them, explaining that we'd just crossed from the Isle of Man. Well, I was quite surprised when they asked me if I could attend the following day. I was over the moon, but wondered how many others had applied for the job. We arranged with Mrs. Halliwell to mind the children the following morning while we went in for the interview. So we set off and we found the College of Science and Technology. It was a big red brick building in Sackville Street, Manchester, not far from Piccadilly. We didn't have to wait long before we were shown into a room for the interview. It was quite a large room with a long table in front of the windows. Sitting with their backs to the windows were six men. It gave me quite a surprise to see so many people for an interview. There was the assistant work superintendent, a Mr. Crosby from the bursar's department, the assistant bursar, the president of the students' union, and the president of the athletic union, students' athletic union, and the president of the staff athletic society. So there were two chairs on the other side of the table from them, and Nina and I sat down there. They asked us all sorts of questions regarding our previous work and our attitudes. Well, they had in front of them my references from the post office, my seaman's discharge book with references in, reference from the lighthouse service, and one that I'd got from Mr. Grimshaw at Dunlop. They seemed quite nice people. They asked all sorts of questions and asked us if we had any questions. The interview lasted, so far as I can remember, about a half an hour. When it ended, we were told that we would hear from them in a few days' time. So we thanked them and left and returned to Rochdale. We didn't hold much hope to get the job, but still, we had tried. From what we were told at the interview, it sounded quite a reasonably good job. I would be assisting the groundsman on the playing fields, but on games days and for evening games and socials, I would be working in the bar, for which I would be responsible for ordering and taking stock and banking the cash. Nina would work, I think it was 20 hours a week, cleaning the building. And then on games days, she would provide teas and the occasional evening socials, provide potato pie suppers or the like, or buffets. All the profits from the catering were to be ours, so it was quite good. When I started, I think my hours were 44 hours a week. I used to start at 8, well, they told me I would be starting work at 8:30 in the morning till 5 at in the evening with an hour for lunch. And then on Saturday, in the mornings, I think it was 9 o'clock to 12, something like that. But it brought a total of 44 hours a week. But all over that was overtime. So it was a much better deal than Dunlop. I think so we worked from about 9 in the morning till 10 or 11 at night there, and we got no overtime. And we waited patiently, and then 3 or 4 days later, we received a letter saying that we had got the situation and to phone the chief engineer and work superintendent to finalise the engagement. I phoned the following day and arranged to go into Manchester. We did that and went into the college, where we met the chief engineer and work superintendent. He was to be our immediate boss. He was in charge of the works department, as it was called at the time, who catered for looking after the buildings and playing fields. It covered bricklayers, painters, joiners, engineers, etc., as well as the ground staff. Now, the works superintendent was an extremely nice man, His name was Ken Bedwood. I took an immediate liking to him, and he seemed to likewise to take a liking to me. He was a big man who always wore a trilby hat, even all day sitting behind his desk in the office. He was very bald, and he was very conscious about it, hence the trilby hat at all times. At the time of the interview, he had been away, so this was our first meeting. He had been told that I was ex-merchant navy, so he asked me what sort of ships I had sailed on. Well, it turned out that he had spent quite a number of years at sea. He had finished up as a chief engineer with the Manchester Liners, sailing to South America. He told us that the new pavilion with the flat in wouldn't be ready for about a month, so we arranged to start then. That meant we could give Dunlop a month's notice, so it worked out all right all round. Well, Mr. Bedwood then said he would take us out to see the playing fields and the pavilion. Just before we got into his car, he told me that I might find that the head groundsman might be a bit awkward, as he was a bit of a peculiar bloke, and his son had applied for the job, but he had been turned down. So that sounded like a good start, didn't it? He took us out of the ground, which was called Mutech, M-U-T-E-C-H. The college was a faculty of Manchester University, hence the name Mutech, Manchester University Faculty of Technology. The ground was situated in a nice area on the borders of Fallowfield. That was about 3 miles from the college along Brook Street and Birchfields Road. Just before you come to the end of Birchfield Road, you turn left into a short road called Lytham Road. The ground was on the left-hand side just as you turned round the corner. And right on the opposite side of the road, facing the playing fields, was Birchfields Primary School, which was grand for us, the children going to school. All they had to do was cross the road and they were in the school. Going right across the road was a railway bridge. The railway lines running the length of the top end of the field. The bottom half of the road was in Fallowfield. The other side of the bridge was in the district of called Levenjune. So actually we were right on the extreme border of Fallowfield. And Mutech was a lovely small ground, 8 acres in size. It contained 3 shale tennis courts, 1 hockey pitch, 1 soccer pitch, 1 rugby pitch, and in the centre, a really good glass cricket square. It was in a beautiful setting. The top end had the railway running along an embankment into from Winslow. The railway line came from Winslow into Piccadilly, and on the other side, the other 2 sides of the field were bordered by semi-detached houses. Really lovely place. At the bottom end of the field, at the end of the tennis courts, was an old wooden building which housed the changing rooms and a big old metal bath. Mr. Bedwood told us that it had been in use for quite a number of years, since before the war. At the other end of the field, up immediately in front of the railway embankment, the new pavilion had been built. Work was still in progress inside. It was an L-shaped building. The long side of the L had on the ground floor 6 changing rooms, toilets and a beautiful tiled bath area. The walls were all tiled and the bath was tiled with white tiles. And there were 8 showers. Above the changing and bath area was a large dining area, or club room, with a beautiful polished sprung floor for dancing. On the left-hand side of the room was a long catering area with a bar at the far end. The catering area and the bar could be closed off by pulling down rolled shutters, wooden shutters. The other side of the room, which was really the front of the pavilion, was all plate glass, overlooking the pictures with a beautiful view, and outside was a balcony. A large cricket scoreboard was at one end of the room. Mr. Bedwood had designed this cricket scoreboard. It was worked from inside the club room by turning wheels, which, by means of bicycle chains, changed the numbers on the outside of the scoreboard. It was really well designed and quite a size too. The short leg of the L had on the ground floor a glass-fronted main entrance and hall, in which was a large telephone kiosk, also enclosed by plate glass. Then there was entrance from the main entrance to the ladies' changing room and toilets. And at the other end of the hallway was a good-sized garage, or what we call the equipment store, for keeping mowing machines, etc., and tools in. Above all this area was the groundsman's flat, the entrance to the flat being at the rear of the building. The outside walls were of rustic brickwork, very nice reddy colour. Below the bath area was a cellar in which was a good-sized gas boiler for